Hello, my name is Harriet Tramer, and I'm your host for Reaching for the Gold. We cover aging in all its various aspects, and I hope you will join us for this broadcast every other Tuesday at this time. Nobody likes the idea of dealing with wills or estates. They're complicated, and they mean facing your own mortality, which is something that makes everybody very uncomfortable. But our guest today, Brad Green, an elder law attorney with Bartramaugh Green in Beechwood, Ohio, should help us to make these matters less mystifying and wearing than they usually are. Brad, who should write a will? Everybody? Just somebody who has a certain amount of assets? Who should write a will?
Everyone should have a will, Harriet. As soon as you turn 18, when you're an adult, you need to have not just a will, but all your estate planning documents done. In fact, you mentioned my partner, Todd Bartramaugh. His son turned 18 before he went off to college last fall, and that was the birthday present that Todd gave to him. He prepared his documents for him. When you're an adult, you need to make sure your affairs are in order, and this is the first step to doing that.
How would a will help you to get your affairs in order? What should it include?
Well, it's not just a will. The basic estate planning documents include a will, but even more importantly, you need to have your powers of attorney done for health care and for financial reasons. The will only comes into play when you're dead. But while you're still living, you need your powers of attorney in place so that if for some reason you're not able to make your either health care or financial decisions, that you've designated an agent who can make those decisions for you in the manner that you would make them for yourself.
Okay, you're bringing up all kinds of very tricky questions here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You say the agent. Now, should the agent be an attorney such as yourself? Should
No.
it be a sibling? Should it be a very close friend?
Right.
Who should this agent be?
Right, good question. So your agent, if you're married, is generally your spouse. If you're not married, if you have children, adult children, an adult child, someone that you trust with your most important matters, someone you trust as much as you trust yourself, really.
And you should fully discuss your assets and your intentions with this person. They need to have a pretty open window.
I don't know that you need to go into your assets with the person. You certainly can if you trust them implicitly, but you don't necessarily need to. They should definitely know, I think, that you have made them your agent in case you should become sick and maybe temporarily or maybe permanently incapacitated and unable to make your medical or financial decisions. But you don't necessarily need to go into all the details about your holdings with them.
Mm-hmm. Could you perhaps discuss your intentions about health matters with them and have a will which discuss your assets and deal with that strictly on a professional level with an attorney? Could you split some of this?
Well, so if I understand your question, even in your will, you don't go into all your assets. You just designate who you want to inherit. And like we said, really the will only comes into play when you pass away. It's the other two documents that we prepare for people, the powers of attorney for health and financial, that really are more important while you're still alive. Even if you didn't have a will, the state would determine who gets your stuff. And it would be a spouse if you had a spouse, children if you have children, siblings if you have siblings. So after you're gone, that's really not even such a huge concern. The bigger issues really are while you're still alive, how are you going to be cared for and by whom, both physically and financially?
In other words, a will, if I'm understanding you, and I think I am, that's something that will just kind of handle itself. The state will deal if you don't have a will. These other matters may be more pressing because they determine your life here. Now,
right.
What happens if I don't have power of attorney for health care? We'll start with that. What happens if
right.
I don't have that?
Right. So the classic case, and we all know of it, is the Terry Schiavo case. So Terry Schiavo suffered a very serious heart attack and lost oxygen to her brain and was what we call brain dead. She had no function and of her brain and was in what we call a permanent vegetative state. Now, she was still conscious, so she wasn't in a coma, but she really had no quality of life anymore. And she did not have a healthcare power of attorney expressing what her wishes were. God forbid something like this should ever happen to her. So what happened was her husband and her parents were pitted against each other. Her husband said she has no quality of life here. They actually did do treatment for her for about 8 years, trying to do therapies for her and saw no help at all, no improvement. At that point in time, she was just being kept alive and had been for 8 years since the stroke on a feeding tube. She couldn't eat. She couldn't drink. She couldn't do anything. She was in what we call a permanent vegetative state and had no quality of life. So her husband wanted to pull the proverbial plug. Her parents said, no, she's still alive. She's still conscious. And that caused about 8 years of litigation in the courts. The courts said the husband is right. She has no quality of life. We should allow him to pull the plug on her. And it went back and forth. President Bush, the first President Bush, got involved in the case even. It got out of hand. So that's the classic case, is if you don't want to end up having your decisions made in the courts and you want to say how you want to be kept alive or not kept alive, you need to do it while you have the ability to do so.
Okay, now that's the extreme.
It is. And after that case, people started saying, wow, I better make sure I have my affairs in order. I better make sure that I've stated whether I want to be kept alive or not under those circumstances. That is the extreme case, in the permanent vegetative state where there's no brain function and no quality of life. Okay, but what about on an interim basis? If you can't make decisions just on a short-term basis, you need to have somebody who can make those decisions for you in the same way that you would have if you could. We have a lot, so that's the health care. Maybe equally as important is the financial one, for financial decisions, so that you have someone who can take care of your business affairs, your house, your banking, your assets, to make sure that you have enough money to live the rest of your life. God forbid you should end up needing long-term care. So the two really are tied into each other. And if you don't have those documents, the court is going to get involved because you'll have to have a guardianship. And really, I don't think anybody wants the courts involved in their life. And that's what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's concentrate on some of these things so they're easier to understand. The power of attorney, I understand what you presented is an extreme case, and I'm sure mm-hmm. it does happen. Mm-hmm. What happens in not such an extreme case, and it's more and more common all the time? Example, somebody has Alzheimer's or some type mm-hmm. of dementia.
Right.
They are receiving kidney dialysis because their kidneys have failed. Now, this person would not necessarily want to have that. They may be in no position to speak up. How can I protect myself and say, look, not only do I prefer extreme measures be kept away from me, but I prefer when I haven't what I would consider acceptable quality of life, that if not extreme measures, because kidney dialysis
right.
is not an extreme measure
right.
in this day and age.
No,
it
not
simply
at all.
Isn't.
Right.
That should not be done. How can I
right.
protect myself in that regard?
Right. Right. So we have to make the distinction between someone who is terminal or someone who is in a permanent vegetative state like the Terry Schiavo case. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The person who has Alzheimer's who needs kidney dialysis, they're not in a terminal condition. And they still have quality of life. We have a lot of clients who are suffering from dementia. And actually, dementia patients do tend to live quite a long time, it seems. Either your mind fails or your body fails, but sometimes, generally not both. I'm not sure which is worse, actually. But that person is not being kept alive through extreme measures on the feeding tube, for example. They're getting the necessary medical care that the circumstance requires. As you said, kidney dialysis is not extreme by any stretch. So the power of attorney is going to make sure, and the doctors are going to make sure that this Alzheimer's patient gets her dialysis treatment. But if you don't have your documents together and you come to us and you have dementia, we're really limited in what we can do planning-wise without having to go to the court and have a guardianship appointed because you haven't stated who you would want to make those decisions for you, and now you can't because you don't have capacity to make those decisions. So while you have the capacity, you absolutely need to say who you want to make those choices for you.
Okay, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But how can I protect myself? In other words, quality of life is a very fungible term. Everybody
mm-hmm.
has a different idea of what that
mm-hmm.
means.
Mm-hmm.
If it is my thought that if I have dementia and I'm in a nursing home situation and
mm-hmm.
I've got this ache and pain and that ache and pain, don't extend it by kidney dialysis. Can I make that clear? And the person who has the healthcare power of attorney can mandate or whatever the proper legal term is that I don't receive that care, or you cannot do that?
Well, what you're doing in a document, you can say anything you want in the document.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, are your wishes going to be abided? Your agent will tell the doctor what your wishes are. You will give the doctors a copy of the document. Again, every situation is unique. You're telling me that you, in your example, we don't have someone who is in a terminal condition. It's not like they have cancer and they're going to die in a short period of time anyway. So it's a question that the doctors are going to make. Dialysis, it can be done in a lot of different ways. Like in a facility, you can do dialysis at home. But it's going to be what you're asking your family or whomever you designate to do for you. I mean, it's a good question. That situation has not arisen because generally, as you said, dialysis is something that is so commonplace now that people are going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a kidney, that patient probably is not going to get a kidney transplant
mm-hmm.
Because of the dementia. Every situation is unique. I mean, that's what we do here. Every situation presents itself in a different manner, different players, different circumstances. And we try to help our families through whatever situation they're in as best we can. But these are tough questions, and there's no blanket answer.
Well, if I feel very strongly that I would not want treatment at that point, might it be a good mm-hmm. idea for me to speak with family members, with my agent, and expresses,
absolutely,
and then that could
100%.
Be expressed to the doctor?
Absolutely. You tell your family what your preferences are. You put it in the paper, in the document, so that your family knows how you feel about it.
Because these things are a slippery slope. At this point, kidney dialysis, I won't say it's routine, but it's not considered, how can I say, cutting edge by any means.
Right.
And, okay, so next year, something that's considered cutting edge now will not be considered cutting edge. It's a slippery slope. It would sound to me, if you have an agent for your health care, that you need to be in pretty constant contact with this person discussing what you want and don't want.
100%. Yeah, especially if you're starting to get sick, and at that point it's a question of what kind of quality of life are you living. And that's really the bottom line. And it's a question of not suffering, and obviously no one wants to prolong mom and dad's life if there's really not much quality of life left.
But again, these are terms that mean very different things to different people.
Agreed.
I mean, very different things. And again, it's changing. What I might consider quality of life now, in 10 years, I may have a very different idea.
I would agree. People are living a lot longer than ever before because of the advances in medicine and the drugs, treatment. But just because they're living longer doesn't necessarily mean they're living better. And you can definitely outlive your money. We see that happen all the time. You can with treatment, a prolonged illness, you could exhaust whatever resources you had while you were still working and earning a livelihood. You can squander it all on your health care in the end.
Okay, now we're coming to our next question, one I've been building up to.
Okay.
These days, $1 million, that sounds like a lot of money, and in some ways it surely is. But that might not be enough to coach you through your retirement, particularly with conservative investments that people have usually put into their retirement accounts, not producing a very high rate of return. A CD, 1%, whatever, low. It is easy to run out of your money.
Yeah.
How can estate planning help with that? I mean, you can't stretch something forever. Can you have a safe fallback, such as, okay, this is how at some point, if I have gone beyond these resources, I can get Medicaid. This is how that can be done. How do you plan something like that? Because many, literally, millions of people who do have some assets will be running out of money if they live into their 90s, which is hardly unusual these days.
Right, exactly. We generally say if you have $2 million, you're probably not going to outlive your money. If you have less, there's no question that you can. And I'm a parent. I think every parent wants to be able to pass something on to their children, as opposed to paying it out over to the healthcare providers or a nursing home. We want to be able to pass a legacy on to our children. And it's not unusual these days to outlive your money. And yes, there is a state fallback, which is Medicaid, and we do Medicaid planning here. And you don't necessarily have to have spent all your money in order to get on Medicaid. There are planning techniques that we employ so that we can preserve assets for someone's future medical care and maybe pass something on to the children, but certainly to make sure that you have enough money to live on. We all work very hard all our lives. And I think the last thing we want to do is give it over to medical care in a last illness. And it's especially when you have a situation where there's a husband and wife, and one of them gets sick, and the other one is still going to need to survive in the community for the rest of his or her life.
Wow.
So we certainly don't want to impoverish the community spouse trying to take care of the ill spouse. So that's the fallback, is Medicaid. What we do with couples in that circumstance, when someone comes to us whose husband or wife is ill, we'll recommend that the well spouse look into long-term care insurance if they can get a policy, and do Medicaid planning for the ill spouse. But again, every situation is unique, and you have to look at all the circumstances to make sure that a family is protected in every possible way.
Now, I hear what you're saying, but again, one glitch comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid regulations are constantly changing, and if I understand it correctly, Medicaid is part state, part federal, so state regulations come into play there too if you move. Wouldn't you constantly have to be reconfiguring these things to comply with new Medicaid regulations? You can't just write a Medicaid plan and expect that to be sufficient forever.
Well, Medicaid is complex. There's no question about it. And it is a federal program that is operated by the states. But as far as someone getting on Medicaid in one state and then moving to another, that's really not an issue at all. If you qualify in one state and you move to another and establish residency in a day, you can get benefits in the state that you move to.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an intention of residing in the new state. And we have people that do that all the time. We have clients who move here from California, from Florida. Sometimes it's harder to get benefits in other states than it is in Ohio. And we can almost always, with the proper planning, figure out how to get somebody benefits and preserve their assets.
Okay,
make sure that everyone's, the nursing home included, is taken care of.
Okay, but what I'm not understanding,
mm-hmm.
when you say planning, is this
mm-hmm.
planning that has to be constantly reconfigured? Or if
not so
I'm
much.
60 and I come in and I want this planning, that's done, that's in force, goodbye. I'm not understanding that.
Okay, so if you come to us at 60 and you're well, there are planning techniques that we can employ that can position you to get benefits in the future if you should need them. There's pre-planning and there's crisis planning. Most people come to us in crisis. As we started the conversation, Harriet, you said most people don't like to confront their mortality.
Oh, no, they don't.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. So most people who come to us come in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to do for my husband. I don't know what to do for my mom or dad. Please help me to figure
mm-hmm.
this out. And that's what we do. And that's usually crisis planning.
Mm-hmm.
But there's pre-planning as well. Again, every case is unique.
Okay, Brad, thank you very much for being our guest today.
You're very welcome.
And thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye. My name is Harriet Tramer, and I'm your host for Reaching for the Gold. I hope you'll listen to us every other Tuesday afternoon at this time when we deal with all facets of aging. Some proponents claim that yoga can work wonders as it improves people's mental and physical health. Others are not, however, so certain about its potential. They question if it might be too taxing for aging people, possibly even harming their muscles or joints. Emmy Cleave, who teaches Bagram yoga, will be clearing up some of this mystery for us. Emmy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be speaking with you. And especially speaking about yoga, because it's been my passion for 60 years.
Wow.
Yes.
It is commonly assumed that as people age, their bodies become less flexible, more tightened into themselves. Can yoga help prove that an assumption is incorrect? Can it help people of any age be more flexible?
Absolutely. There's no, absolutely no doubt in my mind. I'm a living example of that myself. And I, of course, I have taught thousands of people over the last 40 years since I started teaching. And there is just absolutely no doubt in my mind that if there is truly a fountain of youth, it is yoga. And it all depends how intelligently the postures are strung together and how good your teacher is, how well you, you know, how much you benefit from your efforts.
Now, yeah. When you talk about benefit, that's a pretty broad word. You're talking about physical benefit, mental benefit, people saying that not only do folks' bodies become tightened and less flexible as they age, but also their minds. Can yoga help to loosen people's minds, make them more open to new things, more understanding, getting new insights? Can it help them mentally as well as physically?
Well, you see, the basic principle that is a governing principle of yoga is mindfulness, the mind-body connection. And in that, yoga is definitely a superior vehicle for achieving a strong yet supple body and mind, not just the body. Because each classical yoga posture, no matter who, you know, what lineage it is, but all of them are very specifically, anatomically, physiologically, neurologically, and psychologically exerting an effect on the human body. And like I said again, the intelligence of putting the sequence together that you're going to practice will determine how much you benefit from that. And, you know, there are very many people who are not very experienced and don't know what they're doing, and then it's blind leading the blind. But if you get to a good teacher, practice a good system of yoga, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that it will totally change your life, as it has changed mine. Because I started, actually, my first experience of yoga, of hatha yoga, we're talking about the physical aspect of yoga, there are many branches of it. But I started 60 years ago in a jazz dance class, because that's where I went to lose some weight. I just had a baby, and so I was going to get my body back. And the warm-up was this wonderful stretching program he had, and I wanted to do more and more of that. And so basically he finally got tired of me and said, if you like it so much, go get to a yoga class. I never even heard of yoga. And so this is where I found a little Hindu guy down the street in West L.A., and I started doing yoga, and that I never stopped. It has been my primary physical fitness vehicle for the last 60 years. So I can totally testify to it, and it's that I've maintained glowing good health, and I have my weight is the same as I was. I had in high school. I weigh 115 pounds, and I'm 5'5". I still teach every week. I traveled. I just returned from Africa. I traveled there and visited some of the yoga studios and gave some seminars. Also visited our elephant family. We rescued an elephant family from Kruger Park. They were supposed to be culled, and we transported them to a private reserve, and they have blossomed. They've grown to a big family of 80 from 10.
Wow.
I'm very excited about that.
Now, I am very impressed by what you say yoga has done for you. Mm-hmm. Can you give our listeners an example of how it has greatly benefited somebody else? In other words, somebody came into yoga,
yes,
and
well,
they had this problem, that problem.
Right.
Yoga helped to lift it. Can you give an example?
In the very first year that I took up with Bikram yoga, and that that is done in a heated room, and it's really you also would probably wonder how it benefits older people. I think it's absolutely the best way for an older person to start, because they do get stiffer if you don't move. you get stiffer. You're not meant to get stiffer, but, you know, it's just your lifestyle that determines. It depends how you lead your life. And but anyway, within that first year, there was, when I started teaching, there was a young woman who had had polio in childhood, and that left her unable to, like she couldn't hold the baby. She had a baby, and she couldn't hold it because her arms were affected from the after effects of the polio. And so she, after about 3 months or so, she came in one day, and she was just so excited and crying. And she said, the first time I was able to hold my baby, I can hug my baby now. My arms are functioning normally. And it was just, you know, I was just, I never imagined that could happen like that. But, you know, that was one of the things that really had a powerful impact on me, because I really, that was one of the reasons I committed then to being so involved in teaching all and you know, all I could convince to be there and learning more about all the different styles of yoga. And anyway, it's been a wonderful life, because I have had, this is just, that was a very dramatic instance, but there have been many people who come in as with back pains and knee pains and neck pains, and they come overweight, and they have diabetes, and they lose the weight, and they get off the meds for the or blood pressure meds. Really, it's, you know, you have your own internal pharmacy that is always available to you. The body is self-healing and self-repairing if you deal with the body the right way. And that's where yoga is the perfect vehicle for that.
Okay, I'll give you an example. And you tell me how you think yoga could benefit that person. Somebody
well,
is...
Well, I can tell you about myself.
Go ahead.
When I was in my mid-30s, what was I, about 35, I had a wonderful life. I had a... my good marriage, I had my baby, and I was had a wonderful job. And then one day, as I was dictating to my secretary, I collapsed. I apparently passed out, stopped breathing, was on the floor, and I had a brain hemorrhage. And so then that was, I was then transported to a hospital. And there was a ruptured aneurysm, a blood vessel, and that was actually something that my father died from. So that's it was just fortunate I was in a country where the medical system was able to revive me, because I was literally dead. And so then I was, after coming home from the hospital, I knew yoga. I was not yet with Bikram yoga, but I had, practiced all kinds of yoga. So I was starting, roll out of bed on the floor and started stretching, and started doing the exercises that I knew. And within about 6 months, when the doctor was ready to send me to physical therapy, I was already up on my feet and walking up and down the stairs, and everything was in good working order. And it has been since then, and I have no problem standing on my head now, not only on my feet. So, again, I think that I could not imagine anything that I find as effective to really create good health, because good health is created on a cellular level. And it's what kind of the quality of your health is, and what the quality of your life is. And, of course, yoga science is a science, because it does so affect so many systems of the body at the same time. It's not just a musculoskeletal system, but it's all the various circulations of the body. Only heart is a pump for the blood, but there are other fluids in your body. They're only moving through your movement. And if you don't move, your lymphatic system will get sluggish, and you get, tired and achy and unhealthy. And then, of course, your spinal column has to be moved all the time to get the spinal fluid to go from the brain to the rest of the body and through your spinal joints. And so all that is absolutely the mechanisms by which the yoga works on the physical body, or what I want to call the quantum mechanical body, because there's also a lot of energy fields that we are affecting through our lifestyles. Because yoga, they believe, is multidimensional. Not just the physical body, but there's a mental body and ethereal body, and there's a lot of other aspects to it, which I think we're getting a little too far removed from. People are more related to the Hatha yoga, which deals with the physical body. And it's accessible to people of all ages and all conditions. You can stand on your 2 feet, you're ready to start practicing. And it only requires a normal range of motion, and it's an incremental process. And the first thing which you do is you go to a class, you start correcting your bad body mechanics, because when you start sitting a lot, you get terrible postural dysfunction. But then you start repeating the postures gradually, slowly, each day getting a little better, and the people who thought they are too stiff or too inflexible or too weak, they find that it's not true, that they have so much power over their own body. The yoga is self-empowering. That is what I really relate to, because I don't want to put my health in the hands of other people. I want to be in charge of myself. And so that's what this offers you.
Since I've been taking yoga, I mean, I'm not with your record. I'm only at it for about a year. One thing seems to be coming pretty clear to me that I've had to learn. I'm fairly flexible. Okay, I can bend down and put my hands on the floor.
Yeah.
My teacher, who is excellent, says, you got to get your hips back and be more concerned about your positioning than you are whether you get your hands on the floor.
Exactly. You have
now,
a good teacher.
It took me about the last year, and believe me, I'm still working on it, to move away from the idea, oh, I can do this, I can get my hands on
the
floor.
No. You always have to, see, it's a self-discovery. You find yourself in the practice of yoga. And when you find that God's gift to you is flexibility, usually those people have to work for strength. So you have to get the muscle fibers to start firing in a higher level to support your flexibility. And that will ultimately create balance between the two aspects of the body. Because we always struggle to stand upright in gravity. Gravity is a force ever present that tries to push us over. And if you don't have the strength and both balance in front and back of the body, then that's when you start developing problems. You start getting spinal problems or hip problems or knee problems. But all that can be corrected. And when you found that you can now work with a little more strength, I'm sure that you have a much happier experience in yoga. You reestablished your musculoskeletal balance.
Now, one other thing, or a very important thing, you were discussing the great wonders of yoga, and I in no way doubt it. There's no way I can. I don't, you know, measure for other people what it's accomplishing for them. But with everything, you have to be careful. You yourself said an intelligent teacher.
Yes.
Now, if I'm interested in yoga, how can I be certain, if I don't know yoga myself, how can I be certain that the person I'm taking lessons from is the type of individual who should be instructing me, that I'm really getting a benefit from what I'm doing and not risking an unnecessary injury or simply finding it's not accomplishing anything for me?
Well, so this is where I I can only go back to the system that I have been with for the last 40 years, and that is the Bikram Yoga system, because there the teachers are, they all have to finish a certain training. They can only teach if they have passed the teacher training and have a teaching certificate that they have, and have, they have to follow the posture flow. Now, the 26 postures that constitute the Bikram Yoga system are the kind, they're the kind of postures that even if you are coming in with aches and pains and problems, you will never be pushed into the pain. You always start to the level that you're capable of doing. The main thing that they teach you is do the posture the correct way. If you can do 10% of it in the right way, then next day you're going to do 11%, and next day 12% better. And ultimately you'll get to the 100%. But never pushing, whenever you get to a class where people try to push you into something that your body isn't ready, or you feel that you aren't ready, or make you stand on your head or something like that, then run as fast as you can. The people who teach have to be healers, because this is what a yoga teacher is, a healer. And the first order of a healer is first do no harm. And that's what the Bikram system follows. And the, you know, you start at the lower level and then step by step acquire the right form and the maximum benefit. But you're still benefiting as you continue practicing, because you're just going with trying to establish nature's design of your body's structure.
It sounds from what you're saying as if your body, your mind, everything will tell you whether the course you're traveling with yoga is an appropriate course, that you will know.
Yes, mindfulness is the rule that you follow, because this is now the one thing we don't actually teach as a thing, in as a subject in Bikram Yoga, meditation, but mindfulness. You need mindfulness in order to stand on one leg and do whatever you do with the rest of the body, or if you're going to any kind of posture that involves balance and concentration, your mind has to be 100% connected to that activity, and everything else has to leave your awareness. And this is the practice and awareness that you develop about your own body. The mindfulness is what really will ultimately tell you that you are in the wrong place for your body at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you had any experience, or are you aware of any experience of using yoga with people who have some memory problems?
Well, yeah, there are people who have dementia to some, not very advanced dementia, because usually they're not ready to do for a class. You know, in a class situation, they would be too stressed probably. But, yeah, mild cases of dementia, the beginning stages of it, there have been people definitely who have. You know, it's a great de-stressor. No matter if you're a normal person stressed or an ill person stressed, the stress, if you can discharge any amount of it, it is one of the greatest benefits of yoga, I think, the stress relief.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have discussed how yoga can benefit people who may have a chronic disease, mm-hmm. like high blood pressure, diabetes.
Right.
If you were to say that to a doctor, would they say, huh, what are you talking about? That's not medical treatment? Or are more and more doctors saying, well, yes, it might benefit people?
Well, all I can say is that the chief of cardiology at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles actually sends what he calls the failed interventions of people who have had triple bypasses or something and they still have pain. He will send them to the hot yoga class, and the pain will be ameliorated.
Really?
Yes.
People who've had triple bypass.
Yes. And, of course, people with stents and all that, that's nothing. The class is full of people like that. It's medicine and yoga are totally complement each other. But the only reason doctor wouldn't send people to yoga is if he fears it's going to lose a customer, a patient. That, you know, it's a competition.
Is there a danger that yoga is being oversold? In other words, I'm sure it can be extremely beneficial, but is there a danger that some people don't quite understand that the transformations, the benefits, can take literally years and may be subtle, may not be something they even recognize right away, and become very discouraged when they get into this practice and, hey, it's the same old, I feel the same. Is there a danger of that happening, of unrealistic?
But yoga has been around for 5,000 years. And, you know, in those 5,000 years, I'm sure there have been millions of people who've had all kinds of experiences. Some people who look for quick cures or fast miracles, this is not a pill. And it is a system that empowers you. It's a vehicle from which you can create good health. I call it the key to the kingdom of health. It depends how you... how many doors you want to open with it, and how well you then deal with what life brings your way. Are you learning to breathe properly? Because oxygen, there are four things that the human body needs. Number one, and the most important one, is oxygen. If you don't have good oxygen supply, you're going to be chronically suffering from all kinds of diseases. And deprivation of oxygen for just a couple of minutes means death. The next thing you need is water. Without water, you can only live a few days, and then your history. The third thing is you need good nutrition. You have to have, you know, find what your body needs and what your diet, your food chain is. You know, all the animals in the world have a certain food chain, except the humans. They don't know. They're so stupid. They just shove anything in their mouth. But find what works for you. And the fourth and most important thing you need is movement, because life is movement. The human body was designed for movement. No movement, and there's really just sitting and fatting and dying prematurely. That's what happens.
Emmy, thank you very, very much for being our guest. And my name is Harriet Tramer, and I hope you'll join us every other Tuesday for this show, and I hope you will join us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/justwantotalk1, or come to our face page at bbsradio.com/reachingforthegold. Thank you.
Radio.com/reachingforthegold.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Emmy,
uh-huh.
Do you have an email address where I can reach you so when this is on or when this is archived, I can tell you and you can put it on your Facebook page or whatever would be good?
Yes, you can email it to Emmy.
Emmy
at Wildcon, WILDCON, as in Norman, .org.
Wildcom, WILDcom, .org.
Yeah, not a com, not an M, an N at the end. Like for conservation, it's wilderness conservation.
Wildcom.org.
Yes.
Okay,
correct.
I'll be sending you an email.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.